the life and career of Mike Nichols. Mike had a huge impact on American pop culture and entertainment. He was only in his 20s when he and Elaine May made audiences laugh with their smart and innovative improv comedy. Mike then directed four straight hit plays and went on to help reinvent American cinema with iconic films like Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf and The Graduate. Journalist and author Mark Harris has written the detailed and deliciously addictive biography called Mike Nichols, A Life. Mark talks about Mike's unique legacy as both an accomplished director of stage and screen, and how Mike's trailblazing comedy grew from his rough start to life.
He came from Berlin as a little boy of 7 with his younger brother, who was about 4, just before it was too late for Jews to get out of Germany. It was 1939. He came over to join his father, who was a doctor and was trying to set up a practice. And then very soon after that, really close to the last possible minute, their mother came from Berlin as well. By that point, Mike had lost all of his hair because he had a reaction to vaccination that robbed him of the ability to grow hair for the rest of his life. So he really began life in New York City as a refugee and a kind of double outsider, a kid who didn't sound like other kids, a kid who didn't look like other kids. And then at a fairly early age, his father died. So it was really, there is nothing in the early years of Mike Nichols to suggest that he was going to become who he became.
Mm-hmm. How do you think Mike drew on this sense of being, as you describe it, a double outsider? How did he draw on that when he was an adult directing plays and films?
It's interesting because I'm not sure that he ever fully acknowledged that that was how his life began, that that was how his story began. But one of the things he did talk about a lot was that when you're an outsider as a kid, you become, almost as a means of survival, a really acute observer. That just to get through a day in his early life, Mike had to look at other kids and assess, who are the popular ones? How do they act? What do they give off that lets you know they're popular? What do they give off that lets you know they're insecure or worried about something? And I think that kind of precision, that time he took to notice things, really fueled his first big career before he ever became a director, which was as an improv comic performer with Elaine May. I mean, all of their comedy depended on really close observation of the little tics and vanities and insecurities and pretensions of the people that they were playing.
Just think how I feel, will you? Will you think how I feel?
I do, I know.
George is my best friend.
Your best friend?
He's my best friend.
He's my husband. Oh. One of the sweetest, gentlest people.
Oh. He's a saint.
Oh, what a good person he is.
No, he's a saint. He's a saint.
Right.
He's a saint.
Right.
The man is a saint.
You're right, he's a saint.
He happens to be the only saint I know.
He is.
He's a kind.
Isn't he?
A loving.
Oh, you don't know.
Trusting.
Trusting, you don't know.
I know.
You don't know,
I know
how he trusts me. He trusts me. I couldn't do it if he didn't trust me.
They had to play it in a way that was recognizable to an audience. And I think that once Mike stopped being a performer in 1962 and became a director a year later, he carried that over into his work with actors. It's the kind of performance that he really liked to draw out of an actor, something very specific and very real. And it's also the kind of performance that he could help an actor find their way to.
Mm-hmm. In 1966, Mike directed his first film, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, based on Edward Albee's play of the same name. The film starred Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton. What was Mike's working relationship with Taylor and Burton like?
It was really, really strong. I think not only with Taylor and Burton, but with the other two actors in the movie, George Segal and Sandy Dennis. What Mike did on his first movie was really to create a kind of us against the world atmosphere, that his feeling was, you know, you're the highest profile couple in the world, which was indisputably true of Burton and Taylor at that time. This is an unbelievably high profile and high pressure project. It was one of the most talked about plays probably of the last 5 or 10 years. And it was a movie that, if done right, would really shake up the censorship system that governed movies in America at that time. And Mike's attitude was complicity. He would say, you know, you and I are partners in this creative thing that we're going to do. And our job is to push everyone who wants to interfere away and just try to do the best thing we can do. My job is to try to get the best performance from you and from you. And your job is to just come ready to do it.
Until he watched for a couple of years and started thinking that maybe it wasn't such a good idea after all, that maybe Georgie boy didn't have the stuff, that maybe he didn't have it in him.
Stop it, Martha.
Like hell I will. You see, George didn't have much push. He wasn't particularly aggressive. In fact, he was sort of a flop. A great big fat flop.
Stop it, Martha.
I hope that was an empty bottle, George. You can't afford to waste good liquor. Not on your salary, not on an associate professor's salary.
Really, from his very first movie, he created a situation where his actors, and Burton and Taylor were really, really different actors in terms of their facility with language, their experience with rehearsals. Burton was a very serious actor. He'd done a lot of stage work. He had done a lot of classics. Elizabeth Taylor had never even been in a rehearsal before Mike asked her to rehearse for Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. Yet they both trusted him completely. And that was a hallmark of Mike's work with actors throughout his entire career, that he knew not just what every actor needed, but the different thing that each actor needed to create that kind of trust.
Yeah, for sure. How was Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf received by critics and the public?
It was received really, really well. I mean, even though it was this serious, somewhat highbrow play, Warner Brothers, which made the movie, knew that the combination of Burton and Taylor in the starring role, and not just in the starring roles, but in a story that was really about what happens in a marriage behind closed doors. So in some ways, it almost seemed to play with the whole mythology around Burton and Taylor themselves. Warner Brothers knew that the combination of that and the really rough language, the raw content, the sort of shocking, unsuitable for children vibe that the movie had was going to make it a huge hit. And it really was, but it was also a very, very big critical success. I mean, whatever nits critics picked with different aspects of it, I think they were all kind of shocked and impressed that Mike Nichols, who had never directed a movie before, was able to pull this off, and not only pull it off, but show them something that they hadn't seen in an American studio movie before.
Hmm. Mike's second film is the one he's probably best known for, The Graduate, which was released in 1967. He cast a then-unknown Dustin Hoffman as Benjamin Braddock. How did Mike treat Hoffman while they were making the movie?
You know, it was really a complicated combination of things, their relationship. Mike handpicked Dustin Hoffman. He handpicked him over a lot of more likely stars, certainly over better known stars, because nobody knew who Dustin Hoffman was when The Graduate was made. And the way he treated Hoffman throughout the shoot, which was very long and very taxing, was with a combination of great encouragement and almost punitive severity. I mean, he would take the time with Hoffman to work out some particular feeling that Benjamin was supposed to have in any given scene. They would talk. Mike would talk about his youth. Dustin Hoffman would talk about his youth, and together they would get to something really special.
Listen, Elaine, it seems to me that there isn't a bar here. I mean, as far as I know.
Of course there is. Look, there's the palm room right there.
Good evening.
Hello.
How are you, sir?
Good evening, Mr. Gladstone.
Hello again.
Hi, Mr. Gladstone. How are you this evening?
Benjamin?
Let's get out of here, Elaine. Let's go somewhere else.
Do they know you?
Of course not.
Good evening, sir.
Come on, Elaine. We're leaving.
Mr. Gladstone, how are you?
Benjamin, what's happening?
I don't know. They must think I look like this guy Gladstone.
Hello, Mr. Brandis.
When Hoffman wasn't getting something, or when Mike wasn't happy with what he was getting, he could be really tough. And I think Dustin Hoffman told me by the end of the shoot, I don't think they really cared whether I lived or died. And I think he was half kidding, but really, everyone who worked on The Graduate says the shoot was absolutely exhausting and taxing. And really, they didn't know what they were making. Mike had the movie in his mind, but I don't think anyone involved in The Graduate, even Mike, knew what kind of a sensation it was going to be.
What is it about The Graduate that makes it such an iconic film?
Well, one really unusual thing about The Graduate is that it can be taken different ways depending on the age you are when you see it. I mean, I first saw The Graduate when I was younger than Benjamin, and he seemed like a real hero to me. And as you go through your life, in many ways, he becomes a less and less sympathetic character. When I saw it when I was in my 40s, suddenly I thought the heart of this movie, in a way, is Anne Bancroft's character, Mrs. Robinson. And she did not seem like the villain she seemed to be when I saw it when I was very young. She seemed almost a tragic figure. So I think that's one thing. And I think another thing is that even though The Graduate was taken as this kind of generation gap rallying cry when it opened in 1967, the movie isn't really that. It was criticized by some young people for, you know, not showing student protests and not dealing with the Vietnam War or with the civil rights movement. But Mike Nichols always really insisted, and so did Buck Henry, the screenwriter, that it was really a movie about a privileged, cosseted young man who was slowly beginning to rebel against the materialism and affluence that he had been absolutely surrounded by from the time he was a child. And I think that theme stands the test of time a little better than a very specifically late 1960s take on youth versus middle age would have.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I think you're absolutely right about that. Meryl Streep, Candace Bergen, and Natalie Portman loved working with Mike. Why?
Well, I think there are a couple of reasons. One is that specificity that we were talking about, that Meryl Streep in particular, as an actress, she's very much like Mike Nichols as a director. She's really interested in detail work. She's really interested in how the personality of a character and the motivations of a character and the desires of a character manifest themselves, not just in the words, but between the lines and in physical action. That's the kind of thing that many directors won't take the time to work out or to notice even when an actor is doing it. But Mike Nichols always did. I think another reason, though, was that Mike really loved women. He didn't just love them, he appreciated them. He thought they were good collaborators. He wanted to be a good collaborator with them. And that's not a quality you see in a lot of directors of Mike's generation. He was born in 1931. But all the way through his career, whether it was a creative partner like Elaine May or actresses like Candace Bergen and Meryl Streep and Natalie Portman and Julia Roberts, or writers like Nora Ephron or Carrie Fisher, Mike really liked working with women and wasn't insecure about it at all. He enjoyed having a set full of women, and he didn't patronize them. He thought of them as collaborators, and it seems, you know, even today, that's not an entirely normal thing. And when Mike was directing, it certainly wasn't.
No, most definitely not. In the acknowledgments to your book, you write that there wasn't a day that you worked on your book that you didn't think of one more question you wished you had asked Mike. Can you point to one question that you most wished you had asked him?
I'm not sure what the one question would be, but I know that the first word of the question would be why. Because the thing that I was really trying to figure out in the book was how everything connects. It's easy to figure out chronology. That's just sort of a matter of research. But what impelled him to go from point A to point B to point C, those were in some ways the hardest moments to fill in. Why did you make The Day of the Dolphin? Why did you stop directing movies for 7 years in the 1970s and 80s? Decisions like that, even if the answer might not have been completely factual, there were places where it would have been really illuminating to hear what he thought about why he did something. And, you know, without that, it was my job to do everything I could to figure it out anyway.
Mark Harris, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Mark Harris is the author of Mike Nichols, A Life. You can find out more about Mike Nichols at WPR.org/beta.
Law enforcement caught up to her in the end of the 1980s because of an Unsolved Mysteries episode that had aired.
Coming up, director Zachary Drucker talks about the strange but true story of Liz Carmichael and her efforts to sell America on a revolutionary new vehicle. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.